Hello and welcome to Eluda Dogma's Shades of Murder, a podcast where I will share and discuss tales of true crime, mysteries, and all things dark and macabre. If you eat, play, and dream in Shades of Murder like me, then welcome, my kindred spirits, to your new podcast home. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and subscribe, share, and rate, so I may present more stories to you, and we can all embrace the allure of the darkness together. All of my contact information you can find in the episode description below. Please be forewarned that each episode contains specific and at times very graphic and disturbing details of the case and may not be intended for all audiences. I would first like to address how the facts of this story were only found through two resources. The primary source was the White Mountain Independent online and through azdailysun.com. Considering the brutality of this case, what a senseless tragedy it was, and how the judge's sentencing of the offender surprised everyone involved, I was shocked to find that this story had such little coverage. It's a very important story to tell, to acknowledge the victim, and to address and discuss elements of the perpetrator's lives that helped to lead to such a heartbreaking ending for six young people. On May 28, 2006, an unprecedented sentence was handed down that would make historical justice for Indigenous victims. Statistics have shown that for violent crimes committed against marginalized groups, especially those involving Indigenous people, the punishments rarely meet the definition of justice. Many first-degree murder charges have been downgraded to second-degree or even manslaughter. As a result, the victims and their families are rarely granted any sense of real justice. This case was an extraordinary exception. The presiding judge on the case elected to ignore the recommended federal sentencing guidelines for the crimes and instead punished the offenders beyond the maximum penalty. It is rare when a judge utilizes their right to exceed the sentencing under federal judicial guidelines, which many have disagreed with, under the premise that they are being given too much power. However, when a crime is deemed to be so revolting and cruel that the minimal sentencing guidelines are not sufficient enough of a punishment, it is justified for a judge to step in and increase the penalty. This is the story of Martha Rae Bones, a young White River Apache woman and mother of three, who was murdered by people whom she believed to be her friends. 25-year-old Martha Rae Bones went out to see a friend and then vanished. She was not heard from or seen after July 2, 2005. Celebrations and fireworks for the 4th of July came and went without any sign of the young mother. There was no information as to when she was reported missing and when law enforcement began to investigate. There was also no information as to who or what led them to the house of one of her assailants, but eventually the police did. On July 10, 2005, the ravaged body of Martha Rae Bones was found buried in the backyard of Jeremy Hoffman's residence. A young woman's horrific and senseless murder led five young adults to be faced with the end of their futures when they were charged with first-degree homicide. Four men of the White Apache tribe, Jeremy W. Hoffman, 21, Carlton James, 24, Alvin W. Johnson, 22, Gallison Cheney, 24, and one woman, a Mexican national, Blanca Gonzalez, 28, were now faced with first-degree murder charges, in addition to other felony charges, including felony murder, first-degree kidnapping, and conspiracy to commit murder. In a federal court in Flagstaff, Arizona, all five of the defendants were indicted by a grand jury for the horrendous murder of the young woman. The events of that night were believed to have played out as follows. The young female victim, 25-year-old Martha Rae Bones, had been at the residence of the youngest defendant, Jeremy Hoffman's, on the day of her murder. While she was there, Martha began to ask the group questions, which they believed was a probe into their drug-related activities. Specifically, Martha inquired with Carlton James about his owing drug money to some Mexican drug traffickers for the methamphetamine and marijuana which she knew Hoffman had been dealing on the reservation. This triggered an angry and paranoid response in Jeremy Hoffman, who turned on Martha and accused her of being a rat. He called her a snitch and accused her of being a narc on him for the police. Hoffman told her that the Mexican drug cartel was going to kill him. All five defendants were frequent users of methamphetamine, and on this particular day, their high took a turn to the darkest of sides. They all jumped in on Jeremy Hoffman's accusation towards Martha Ray, ratting them out to law enforcement. This was an accusation that was based on nothing but their drug-fueled paranoia and heightened delusions. This delusion of her being an enemy took root in all of them, and they turned on Martha in the most extreme and evil of ways. Their mindsets became desperate and unhinged. This is when they began to beat the young woman. First, one of them stuck a pool ball inside a sock and beat Martha with it. Next, they hit her with the stock of a shotgun, and then a 9mm handgun, and eventually with their fists. Then together, they kicked the young woman with their boots, stomping on her head and neck. They hung Martha Ray on a door and poured bleach down her throat. The defendants claim that the torture of this poor young woman took place over 8 hours in their desperate and delusional attempt to get her to admit who had sent her to the house to snitch on them. As she lay there battered, beaten, and bruised, bleeding everywhere, one of them, presumably Jeremy Hoffman, strangled her with her belt. After they had tortured and murdered this innocent woman, they buried her body in a shallow grave in the backyard of Hoffman's home around 3 a.m. that morning. They gathered the objects they had used to beat her, which contained her blood, and hid them all inside a bag, which was later discovered by the investigators at the crime scene. 4 tribal members and 1 non-tribal individual all pled guilty to the murder. 4 of the offenders had made a plea deal to confess to second-degree murder. Under this conviction, the recommended sentence for imprisonment would have been in the range of 210 to 260 months. Prison sentences are always broken down into months, but to put it into more concise terms, an offender found guilty of second-degree homicide will usually be faced with a 20 to 25-year sentence, with the chance of parole after 80% of the sentence has been served. Judge Frederick Martoni reserved his right to exceed the guidelines, noting that they were completely inadequate for the brutal torture and murder of an innocent young woman. He promised that all involved would face the most severe punishment the law would allow. On May 28, 2006, all 5 were made an exception to the sentencing guidelines. Friends, community members, Martha's mother, and her 3 young children, who held photos of their mom, packed into the courthouse to watch justice be handed down. Judge Martoni discussed his involvement in 100 death penalty cases, which had ended in 22 executions, all of which he pointed out were far less brutal and cruel than the murder of Martha Ray Bones. He acknowledged how he believed this should have been a capital murder case, noting how the severe depravity, twisted mental state, and degree of sadism shown by all 5 offenders involved surpassed most offenders on death row. The judge inquired with the defendants as to why they committed this heinous crime. Gallison Cheney, who was 24 years old, told the judge that the drugs and alcohol were to blame for their actions. Cheney's defense attorney conveyed to the judge that his client was traumatized by the horror of the crime committed, and he would never forget what he was involved with that night. The defendant's reasons for how and why the murder happened were supported by a witness expert, a doctor from UCLA's School of Medicine who was a specialist in drug addiction. Although he testified to how the use of methamphetamines induced psychosis, which can influence the addict to behave in ways that are outside of their normal character, the judge was not affected by these facts. The FBI led the homicide investigation with the aid of both the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the White Mountain Apache Police Department. FBI Special Agent Rominger was at the head of the investigation, and he acknowledged the strong role meth played in this case, discussing the detrimental effects it had on the offenders and, by proxy, their families. However, the judge was not influenced by these experts. He stated that the use of methamphetamine or any other drug for that matter held very little weight in his court, with how deplorable the crime was. Four of the defendants had others speak for them, except for Jeremy Hoffman, who was the primary instigator and orchestrator of Martha's torture, and whose hands ultimately took the young woman's life. He expressed deep remorse and disgust towards his actions, saying to the judge in the courtroom, and I quote, "I should get the death penalty. There's no sentence great enough for what I did." Jeremy Wayne Hoffman, who was considered morally and criminally to be the main perpetrator of Martha's murder, was given a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Co-offenders Gallison, Cheney, and Carlton James were each given 30 years in prison with an additional 5 years of supervision upon release. The oldest offender and the only woman amongst the group of killers, Blanca Gonzalez Herrera, was given 300 months, or 25 years of incarceration and 5 years supervised parole after the sentence was completed. All four defendants were given a $100 fine and restitution to the family for $7,175. This is a piddly amount of restitution for what Martha's loved ones were put through, but as in most restitution cases, it is more of a symbolic fine than anything else. The fifth defendant, Alvin Johnson, was charged with the lesser charge of aggravated assault, which led to the serious bodily injury of the victim. However, even though the sentencing guidelines recommended a penalty of 41 to 50 months incarceration, Judge Martoni gave Alvin Johnson twice that amount and sentenced him to 100 months in prison. The judge, as with the severe punishments given to the other defendants, which all greatly exceeded the guidelines, pointed out that the severe brutality and cruelty enacted against the victim made his participation in the assault worthy of a harsher penalty. This is the penultimate example of when it can be beneficial for a judge to have the power to exceed the federal sentencing guidelines. Unfortunately, other judges have used it in ways that are more harmful than beneficial to the justice system. Here is a little bit of background on the federal guidelines for sentencing and how they are structured. The guidelines encompass 43 levels of offense seriousness. They are centered around two main factors. The first is the conduct associated with the offense, in other words, the severity of the crime. The second is the criminal background or history of the offender. For every kind of crime, there is a base offense level. The more serious the offense, the higher the base level is. Its purpose is to be the origin point of determining the severity of a particular offense. There are specific factors within each crime that can increase or decrease this level. These are victim-related, the offender's specific role in the crime, and obstruction of justice. For example, if the victim was a child or someone who had a physical disability, making them more vulnerable and thus an easier target, the offense level can be increased by two levels. If the offender had a minimal role in the crime, their offense level could be lowered by four levels. With multiple counts within a conviction, there is a combined offense level which is provided as a guideline, with the most serious offense used as the starting point. For an offender who takes full responsibility for their crime, this can benefit them by having the offender's level decline by two levels. The sentencing guidelines also assign one of six criminal history categories, based on the degree of their involvement in criminal activity or their absence of a criminal background. Defendants are assigned a criminal level which can indicate their level of dangerousness, and thus is a strong determining factor in their punishment. In the murder case of Martha Rae Bones, even though not one of the defendants had a criminal history, at least not on their official record, the judge raised their criminal level by seven levels, which is unheard of. This is why, when the federal sentencing guidelines were established in 1987, they were recommended but not enforced. Any judge can sway away from them by increasing or decreasing the suggested penalty, as long as they record their reasoning, noting the aggravating or mitigating factors of the case. That the judge ignored their lack of a criminal background is very rare, and a legal move that some may look down upon. This case is so tragic because it not only took the life of a young woman and mother of three children, but it destroyed the lives and futures of five young adults. Drug addiction does not excuse or explain their behavior, nor is it a reason to give any of the perpetrators a lesser sentence. But the severe and long-term effects this particular narcotic plays on the brain have long been recorded and pertinent to discussion. Beginning as early as the 1950s, there has been an extensive amount of research conducted in the United States and on a global scale that is focused on the positive correlation between long-term and chronic use of amphetamines and aggressive and violent behavior. Although the statistics are a bit muddled on the number of violent crimes that are triggered by its specific use, due to variances in methodology and many other factors involved, crime reports have shown a direct connection between the two variables. This is not surprising given the extreme effects the drug has upon the brain. A huge reason why methamphetamine is so addicting is the euphoria it induces in the user and how long these effects can last. The huge surge of dopamine and serotonin the person who ingests, snorts, or injects methamphetamine experiences is unlike any other drug. It impacts the brain to the extent that it can distort one's perception and drastically alter one's behavior. Millions of people a year in this country alone use the drug because it's relatively cheap for a narcotic, especially in comparison to cocaine or opioids, and because of the extremely high sense of euphoria the user experiences. This substance is extremely toxic, not organic or natural on any level, like marijuana is, for example, and causes unbelievable amounts of damage to the body and to the psyche. Methamphetamine, or MA as it is commonly referred to, is known to not only release serotonin, but also damages its systems. Serotonin and dopamine are neurotransmitters that send messages from the brain throughout the body. The importance of serotonin in the body far surpasses that of a mood-centered neurotransmitter. It also encompasses perception, appetite, memory, sexuality, attention, pain, sleep, and nausea. The levels of serotonin in one's body affect the heart, the bones, the digestive system, the urinary tract and bowels, and the blood. Abnormally high or low levels of this critical neuron can make a devastating impact on the physical and psychological health of the individual. When there's an absence of serotonin, this may induce depression, anxiety, sleeping problems, OCD, PTSD, panic disorders, paranoia, and even schizophrenia. The main distinction between dopamine and serotonin is that dopamine controls the movement and coordination of the body and triggers the reward and motivation parts of the brain. Dopamine is what is released when someone experiences pleasure, whether it is from a delicious meal, shopping, sex, or using drugs. When someone takes a drug or participates in something that gives them this rush, their brain recognizes how this particular substance or activity provides them pleasure. The more they engage in it, the more their brain becomes less responsive. And so to achieve that same level of pleasure or high, the person needs to consume more. The long-term abuse of meth can impair the neurons inside the brain, which affects the levels of dopamine and serotonin. This may lead to irreversible changes in terms of cognitive function and structure, especially in the areas of emotion and memory. Many chronic users experience MA-induced psychosis, which is characterized by paranoia and auditory and visual hallucinations. They frequently suffer from the perception that their environment is hostile territory and view those around them as a direct threat. This psychosis is what is believed to be the trigger for many users to become erratic and violent. Command hallucinations are a specific kind of auditory hallucination that are experienced by users who hallucinate and are particularly disturbing. This involves specific commands that the addict hears, which instruct and encourage them to act out violently. This can include assault, arson, or even property damage. On a personal note, I have firsthand experience with an individual who heard these command hallucinations. I was assaulted by a stranger, a young woman who was clearly on methamphetamines at the time of the offense, who was convinced that I was a zombie, that I was dead, and that she had to destroy me. It sounds like a horror comedy, but it was surreal, bizarre, and terrifying to watch as this young woman was triggered by something inside her head that only she could hear. And because of this delusion, this auditory hallucination, she attacked me. For an individual who uses MA, the density of their serotonin transporter declines by 30% compared to someone who does not abuse the drug, even after a long period of abstaining from its use. Aggression is directly connected to the density of serotonin transporter, which follows the same vein of findings regarding psychiatric patients who are aggressive and violent offenders. A meta-analysis conducted between 1970 and 2009 on interpersonal violence, violent criminal behavior, and individuals who were diagnosed with psychosis, such as schizophrenia, showed a higher risk level for those who also had a history of substance abuse. It also showed that a very close risk level of violence existed for those with or without a psychotic diagnosis when they suffered from substance abuse. These findings clearly indicate the strong relationship between substance abuse and violence. Based on official reports released by the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, as of 2010, there were approximately 33.8 million people worldwide between the ages of 15 and 64 years old who participated in the use of amphetamine-type stimulants. I was very surprised to learn that of the world's consumers, the highest percentage are located in East and Southeast Asia, with North America and Europe close behind. The last two areas not being so much of a shocker. In China, it is estimated that more than 14 million people have tried the drug. A survey regarding MA-triggered emergency cases in the United States revealed that 18.7% involved mental health issues and another 18.4% involved trauma. At least one-third of these cases required the use of sedation due to the aggressive and agitated state of the patient. Research in South Africa discovered that 87% of MA users experience interpersonal violence. In Australia, it was shown in the study of 400 MA and heroin users that 82% had committed acts of violent crime, with users of methamphetamine reporting a much higher rate. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition DSM-5, mental disorders induced by substance abuse are expected to go away within 1 month of abstinence. The International Classification of Diseases, 10th revision, declared that once a person stops engaging in the use of the drug, psychotic symptoms will likely disappear within 1 month and will not be prolonged past 6 months. However, one study done on male MA users found that, for some, their psychosis lasted past 19 months. For some users, psychosis will never go away, and these individuals will eventually be diagnosed as schizophrenics. A study done in Thailand on 1,000 MA users found that for those who suffered psychotic disorders that had been directly induced by MA, almost 40% were given the diagnosis of schizophrenia within 6 years of their first recorded episode. In Finland, a very large study covering 18,478 patients with psychotic disorders induced by using MA found that the risk of being diagnosed schizophrenic was 30%. Research in Japan revealed that 41% of MA users experienced persistent MA psychosis, which lasted between 1 and 6 months. And for 28%, the symptoms lasted significantly longer. Now, is it that MA psychosis exists on its own accord? Or does the MA abuse trigger an underlying pre-existing vulnerability to being schizophrenic? Are they one and the same, or are they uniquely different psychotic disorders? There is also the school of thought that psychoactive drugs severely affect the dopamine system and therefore could make those who abuse such substances more likely to suffer from mental illnesses, in particular schizophrenia. However, as many researchers point out, this belief does not carry much weight since it is methamphetamine use specifically, which has a significantly higher rate of psychosis directly related to its use than any other drug, including cocaine and opioids. Why is this information so relevant to the story of Martha Rae Bones? Because the psyche of all five of her assailants was severely altered by this drug at the time of the offense. In the United States, there are more than 560 independent, sovereign, tribal governments and communities. Amongst these indigenous tribes, more individuals use meth than any other ethnic or racial group in the country. Recent research has shown that 1.7% of Native Americans and Alaska Natives and 2.2% of Native Hawaiians engage in the use of methamphetamines. This number may not sound so high, but when you compare it to 0.7% whites, 0.5% Latinos, 0.2% Asians, and 0.1% of African Americans who participate in its use, the difference is very significant. With more than 70% of methamphetamines being brought in illegally from Mexico, Native American reservations have become a prime target of the drug cartel's business for sales and distribution. They're often on rural lands and can encompass space as large as some states, with little presence of daily law enforcement due to a lack of funding and, in general, complicated when it comes to criminal jurisdiction. Reservations are the ideal place for drug trafficking. Some indigenous communities have recorded as high as 30% of their members using methamphetamines, and it is not just isolated to the youth or the downtrodden. In fact, in 2006, only a year after the events of this tragic case, the White Mountain Apache tribe in Arizona testified in front of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee that 30% of their employees had tested positive for meth. Think about this for a moment. These are the individuals who represent the community, the leaders, people whom the youth look up to and aspire to be like. In a study conducted by the Bureau of Indian Affairs Office of Law Enforcement Services, it was indicated by 74% of the 96 out of 150 tribal law enforcement agencies who responded that meth is considered to be the greatest drug threat to its communities, with as high as 40% of its violent crime directly associated with its use. A survey sent to the 7 FBI offices whose locations are within the vicinity of reservations reported that between 40 to 50% of all violent crimes involved the use of methamphetamines in some way. The Bureau of Indian Affairs study also revealed that 64% of the tribal law enforcement agencies directly connected the abuse of meth to the increase in domestic violence, assault, and battery on the reservations. This drug destroys families, with the National Indian Child Welfare Association reporting that approximately 80 to 85% of all cases involve drugs and/or the abuse of alcohol. The Yavapai Apache Nation in Arizona reported that as high as 90% of their child welfare cases were directly related to the parents' use of methamphetamines. The California Indian Legal Services was even higher, which claimed that in nearly every single case where a child is taken away from the home, at least one of the parents is using methamphetamines, or the child themselves was exposed to it from the womb. The widespread use of methamphetamine amongst the indigenous communities has wreaked havoc upon the lives of its users and their loved ones. Research shows that it has been utilized by its members as well as other substances in an attempt to numb their emotions and temporarily escape from what is known as generational trauma. Although it can be a controversial subject of study, even on its own, social scientists have discovered a direct relationship between generational or historical trauma and substance abuse. Trauma can be a result of many situations in life that have caused an individual psychological harm. When this trauma is not dealt with and healed, it not only keeps that person in a place where they are psychologically impaired, in which they suffer from anxiety, depression, and psychosomatic disorders as a result, but this trauma can pass on to others. Studies in this area have shown the trauma within a family, such as a murder or severe abuse and violence that happened in one generation, can severely affect other members of the family in the following generations, even if they were not directly affected by it. For members of a family or a group who have been subjected to racial, ethnic, and/or cultural violence and oppression, this trauma can severely impact whole communities. Generational trauma, also known as intergenerational and historical trauma, is when a specific racial, ethnic, or cultural group has faced such severe oppression, discrimination, and violence that the trauma experienced by the individual and the group as a whole is passed on through the generations. Research shows that this generational trauma is experienced by members of a group who are impacted by huge events. The groups who may be the most affected are ancestors of slavery, the Holocaust, people who have been forced to migrate from their homes, and the genocide and forced colonization of indigenous people. This phenomenon was first identified by social workers who were involved with children of the Holocaust and those whose parents had been forced into the Japanese quarantine camps during World War II. The survivors were observed to experience attachment issues and felt isolated by their parents. All members of an affected group do not experience this trauma, or at least not on the same level. But for those who do experience it, their existence is often marked by damaged mental and physical health. Historical trauma can surface within the person in many debilitating forms. They will often engage in self-destructive behavior and be involved in violence, in particular domestic abuse. Various forms of substance abuse and alcohol addiction are extremely common characteristics of generational trauma. Victims experience severe depression and other kinds of mental illnesses, high rates of suicidal ideation, in addition to a damaged cultural, ethnic, or racial identity. Historical trauma is multi-layered, intergenerational, and cumulative. It covers the lifespan of the individual affected by it and travels to future generations. Characterized as unresolved grief and a mourning that never ends, this deep depression is passed on to children when they are born, and the mental health issues of the future generations become more severe and entangled with their existence over time. Known as the survivor's child complex, this is a collection of features that a child inherits from their parents' trauma and response to that traumatic experience. This manifests itself in depression, suicidal ideation, and an overwhelming feeling that they have an obligation to their parents and the generations before them who were persecuted and murdered to share in this suffering. Guilt for not having experienced the trauma themselves can lead them to believe that they are traitors to their ancestors if they don't also experience the pain. This deeply embedded sadness can culminate in feelings of hopelessness, anger, and rage that for some lead to a repressed psyche to hold back their emotions altogether. When this anger does rise to the surface, it often leads to alcohol and substance abuse, domestic violence, and even suicide to shut down or silence the psyche. When the Europeans came to this country and colonized the indigenous people and their lands, they interfered with the everyday living domains of these communities. They sought to disintegrate their culture, traditions of socialization and social integration, by forcing the ways of the patriarchy and imperialism upon them. They brought disease and mass genocide of many who were the carriers of tradition, medicinal, and spiritual knowledge. Countless others were forced off their homelands and displaced to other areas of the nation that were not as agriculturally rich, nor did they fulfill their spiritual needs. The sharing of language and ritual was intimately connected to their environment and the once held freedom to migrate as they wished. When the government came and forcibly removed many of their children so they could be subjected to the white colonial constructs of education, this further eroded their social and cultural ways of life. During the 1950s, with the main purpose of assimilating them into the patriarchy and colonial ways of life, many indigenous people were brought into the city landscape to work, essentially trying to make them into middle-class white people. This was a further assault on and violation of their cultural identities. Their religion and spiritual practice were also severely restricted, and many of their ceremonies and traditions were prohibited for centuries. It was not until the 1978 American Indian Religious Freedom Act that they were finally granted the right to practice their spirituality without fear of reprisal from the government, including both federal and state. Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart, a clinician and researcher who works with indigenous communities, defines generational trauma as the, and I quote, cumulative emotional and psychological wounding over the lifespan and across generations, emanating from massive group trauma experience. Stemming from a needs assessment study of Native Americans in Central California during the 1970s, and an analysis of the participants' dreams revealed that the overarching theme was the hostility of the environment and the hostility of the world. As was expressed in the study, the effects of colonization were understood by many indigenous people as a spiritual injury to their lands and their communities. The subsequent damage to the psyche of the community left them with the belief and perception that the outside world was hostile, and this caused an intrinsic lack of harmony. The problems that manifested themselves were merely symptoms of the greater wound. This was referred to as the soul wound. To me, this term fully encompasses and clearly defines how deeply affected individuals' lives are who experience it. There are some, including scholars, who claim that this creates a scapegoat, an excuse for people's poor health, substance abuse, and violent and criminal behavior. They attempt to dispute the legitimacy of this phenomenon, mainly noting that there is a minimal amount of study done on the subject. This is only true in that post-colonial perspectives are relatively new in the field of social science. Still, it is something well known and addressed by Native American elders and healers, as well as those involved in clinical studies held on Jewish survivors and their descendants of the Holocaust. Generations of the descendants of African American slaves and those who were affected by segregation and racist institutions have been profoundly impacted by such events, and many carry this trauma with them every day. For Native Americans whose lands were stolen, their people massacred, and their children ripped away from them to attend colonial schools, this generational trauma is a heavy burden that weighs on many in their communities. These experiences create layers of grief, a lack of trust in society and its institutions, and a detachment from one's own identity. In an article written by Dr. Bravehorse, a study conducted over 9 years by her and her research team analyzed the cases from an urban Native American clinic. These findings have only confirmed these theories. The research shows that the effects on the spirit, mind, and body of these generations who have been traumatized by these events have been detrimental. Substance abuse, including alcohol and drug use, is a major problem in these communities, leading to more than 60% of deaths related to addiction. Issues of poverty, dependence, violence, and alcoholism have destroyed many families due to what the generations have experienced. The tribal police are desperate to help their communities, but a big part of the problem is that they don't have the resources to cover the massive amount of land that reservations encompass. For example, the Navajo Nation in Arizona and New Mexico is the approximate size of the entire state of West Virginia. With many tribal police comprising 2 to 3 officers per shift, it is next to impossible to combat this problem. To offer the most minimal of service levels, the reservations would need more than twice the amount of law enforcement officers they currently have, who are doing their best to prevent crime. Regarding the rampant use of methamphetamines and the ever-escalating violence it causes in their communities, 69% of tribal law enforcement agencies reported that they did not have any tribal-sponsored meth rehab centers. The Indian Health Services are 60% underfunded than what is necessary to provide their members with basic, adequate health care, and treatment programs for meth are significantly costlier and frequently last more than a year. One study found that most communities run out of their annual funding for drug and alcohol treatment in addition to those for mental health a few months into the year. The National Indian Country Tribal Meth Initiative Task Force has since been established to battle the meth epidemic. The task force includes the chief of police, chairpersons, counselors, and local educators. There have been collaborations made with various agencies, such as the DEA, FBI, and the Department of Justice, amongst others, to create anti-meth promotions to help spread awareness as to the extreme dangers and severe harm this drug causes. There has been a lot of recent research on this topic to discover the best ways to help communities and their members heal so that this generational trauma can come to an end. Dr. Maria Yellow Horse Bravehart has created treatment centered around traditional Native American treatment for healing and based on ceremony. She developed a psychoeducational group intervention which is provided to members of indigenous communities at places considered sacred to them. This is designed so that together they reconnect with a positive cultural identity. The institutions established by the patriarchy and colonialism continue to fail to protect the indigenous people from rampant drug use and violence that continues to impede their lives. There should not be any community that does not have the funding necessary to help prevent these violent crimes from occurring and destroying countless lives in the process due to the abuse of methamphetamines. But this continues to occur. Our government persists in ignoring and even worse, whitewashing the history of this nation to serve its patriarchal and elitist agenda. It seeks to uphold the status quo no matter what the cost is to the most marginalized of our communities. And most people in our society just keep their voices hidden. They are self-blinded, electing to be consumed by social media, the trivial, escape from the truth, and not acknowledge the darkness this country was founded on and still is rooted in, which continues to cause unsurmountable damage to those who deserve to be protected the most. Thank you so much for listening to this tragic story of Martha Rae Bones. As the year is winding down, I want to express my most sincere appreciation to every one of you who takes the time to listen to my show. I have one last episode to bring you before 2023 comes to an end. But until then, stay safe and watch over Shades of Murder. Happening in the streets, next door, and especially inside your own home. Alita Dogma's Shades of Murder is created, written, and edited by Alita Dogma. Music courtesy of Pixabay by Ashot Danilian.